Welcome back to the Deep Dive. You know, if you're listening to this right now, you're probably, well, you're looking for ways to step up your financial game, right?
Oh, absolutely. Everyone is.
Yeah. But you want to do it without getting completely bogged down in all that dense Wall Street jargon.
Mm-hmm.
You want real, tangible financial growth from your capital.
Right. Strategy that actually makes sense for the landscape we're in today.
Exactly. And to get to the bottom of this, our mission today is pulling from a highly detailed set of excerpts. It's titled Strategic Wealth Building and Investment Growth in Saudi Arabia.
Which is a fascinating document.
It really is. And it includes some incredibly pointed data-backed insights specifically from the Usul Gamma investment platform.
Yeah, and the data we are examining today tells a completely different story about targeted momentum, specifically in the Gulf region.
So, okay, let's unpack this, because our goal today isn't to just, you know, try to guess the next big stock or place bets blindly. We need to understand strategy and risk.
Right. Before you deploy a single rial or dollar, you have to look at the foundational mechanics of how we're actually getting there.
Which means taking a hard look at the baseline. Because, I mean, you can't navigate a shifting market without a solid foundation.
No, you really can't. And it starts with a rather uncompromising first rule from the source material, which is you have to define your specific target.
Okay, define your target. Sounds basic.
It sounds basic, but the source argues that most investors fail not because they picked the wrong assets, but because they have absolutely no concrete definition of what they are actually trying to achieve.
Oh, interesting. So, like, what's the end goal?
Exactly. Are you engineering passive income to replace a salary? Are you constructing a generational wealth vehicle? Or, you know, are you simply building an inflation-proof safety net?
Right. Because if you don't define that goal, your entire risk profile is essentially just floating in the wind.
Floating in the wind. Precisely.
If you don't know the timeline for your capital, you have no business deciding between, like, a highly illiquid real estate deal and a liquid equity index.
Your goal entirely dictates your liquidity needs, your risk tolerance, and ultimately your psychological endurance.
Yeah, the psychological endurance is huge.
It is. And once that target is locked in, the text heavily emphasizes relying on proven mechanisms.
Stuff over hype, basically.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Things like dollar cost averaging and aggressive dividend reinvestment to do the actual heavy lifting over the long term.
Right. And we all know these mechanisms. I mean, if you follow the markets, DCA and dividend reinvestment are the bread and butter.
They're the absolute standard.
It's basically the financial equivalent of a sustainable fitness routine.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, like you go to the gym, you put in the reps, you apply progressive overload, and over time, the compounding results are just undeniable.
Undeniable, yeah.
But the temptation to abandon that routine is everywhere, right?
Yeah.
It is so easy to fall for the financial crash diet.
The crash diet. That is an incredibly apt analogy here.
You know what I mean? Like piling into a highly leveraged crypto play or a meme stock because you saw it trending online and you want that overnight spike.
Right. The source material explicitly warns against that exact behavioral trap. The psychological friction of investing is that the most effective strategies are, well, often the most boring day to day.
Totally boring.
Right.
Checking your portfolio and nothing wild is happening.
Right. But when you chase the hype, when you buy into that trending stock you read about on some forum, the institutional money has already captured the primary upside.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You are essentially buying in at the peak to provide exit liquidity for the people who got there first.
So you're basically buying the crash diet pills after the scientific study has already debunked them. But, like, the marketing is still running.
Exactly. The marketing is still running. And the underlying data proves this out time and time again. Long-term investors consistently outperform short-term reactionary traders.
Just by avoiding the emotional mistakes.
Simply by avoiding them. It isn't because long-term holders possess some magical foresight or, you know, superior analytical modeling.
Right.
It is simply because their structural strategy removes that emotional vulnerability. If you are automatically dollar cost averaging, you aren't panic selling during a 5% market correction.
And you aren't over leveraging due to greed when a specific sector gets super hot.
Exactly. The strategy protects you from your own worst instincts.
Okay, so personal emotionless consistency is the baseline.
Mm-hmm.
But let's be real here. Returns do not happen in a vacuum.
No, they certainly don't.
You can have the most disciplined, ironclad DCA strategy in the world. But if the macroeconomic environment where your money lives is just deteriorating, your portfolio is going to suffer.
You have to understand the broader environment.
Exactly. So let's transition into that macro picture.
Well, the source material spends significant time analyzing the macro indicators that dictate where the tailwinds are forming. You know, things like interest rates, inflation, government spending.
Right, the big structural indicator.
Exactly. And right now, as we look at 2026, we are finally seeing stabilization after a really brutal, extended period of aggressive central bank rate hikes.
It's funny you mentioned stabilization because looking at the Gulf data from the source, stable almost feels like a massive understatement.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we're seeing stabilization in rates globally, sure.
Hmm.
But in Saudi Arabia, it's colliding with this massive, unprecedented spending spree fueled by Vision 2030.
Right.
It feels less like a stabilization and more like, I don't know, a coiled spring for sectors like fixed income and real estate.
That is the exact dynamic the text highlights. When global interest rates stabilize, the cost of capital becomes predictable again.
And developers love predictability.
It is the lifeblood of large-scale development. And in Saudi Arabia, that global stabilization is acting as a direct accelerant for the localized Vision 2030 initiatives.
Right.
We are talking about historical levels of capital flowing into infrastructure, green energy, and tourism.
But okay, here's where it gets really interesting, because I want to push back on this narrative for a second.
Okay, go for it.
If you are listening to this right now, none of this is a secret to you. Vision 2030 have been making headlines for years. We've all seen the renders of NEM, right?
Of course. It's highly publicized.
Yeah, we've all read about the massive sovereign wealth fund deployments. So if everyone from, like, retail traders to massive hedge funds knows the government is pouring trillions into these transformations, haven't everyday investors already missed the boat?
It's a fair point.
Like, by the time the news is this ubiquitous, isn't all that future potential already fully priced into the market?
It is the most logical question to ask. The assumption that public knowledge equals a saturated opportunity is usually correct in highly efficient, mature markets.
Right.
But the data from the OSIL Gamma platform strongly counters that assumption for this specific region. Let's go back to that statistic we started with.
The foreign direct investment one.
Yes. Foreign direct investment into Saudi Arabia rising 5.6% year on year in the fourth quarter of 2024.
Wait, 5.6% during that whole 2024 rate hangover?
Exactly. Institutional money is still accelerating its entry. It isn't tapering off at all.
Wow. Okay. So it's not slowing down?
Not at all. Because the fundamental reality of these mega projects is that they are not single event catalysts. They are multi-decade structural shifts.
Oh, exactly.
The boat hasn't sailed. We are just moving from the conceptual phase into the execution phase. The text is very specific about where the upside remains.
So it's not just buying a broad index and hoping for the best.
No. If you buy a broad global emerging markets ETF, yes, some of that is priced in. But the real alpha lies in the localized long-term growth sectors that are nowhere near their peak.
Like which ones?
Specifically, local tourism, mega projects, logistics hubs, and the entertainment sector.
The source specifically points to projects like Diriyah Gate and NEOM.
Yeah.
Yes. The infrastructure being laid down for these projects is monumental. Being early in these highly specific, targeted spaces means there is still a massive runway for growth.
Because they're physically building them right now.
Exactly. We aren't talking about a software company hoping to double its user base. We are talking about the physical construction of entirely new economic centers.
Which brings us to a really crucial pivot in this analysis. Because whenever we start talking about massive runways for growth and chasing bigger upside in emerging sectors, we are immediately face to face with the unavoidable twin of reward.
Risk.
Risk. Exactly. You cannot have one without the other.
They are intrinsically linked. And the source material is completely uncompromising about this. Risk and reward are a package deal.
You can't just separate them.
No. And pretending otherwise is how portfolios get wiped out. If you are targeting aggressive growth, you must accept a higher probability of volatility. Startups, early stage tech, they can soar, but their failure rate is inherently high. On the flip side, if capital preservation is your priority, you accept the sluggish returns of bonds or high yield savings accounts.
And then you have asset classes like real estate, which the text notes occupies this really interesting middle ground, right? Especially within the current Saudi market.
It does.
To give us a baseline of how the broader market there is actually behaving, the source highlights that the S&P Saudi Arabia BMI index rose by over 8% in 2024.
which is a remarkable data point.
8% is huge.
An 8% rise across a broad index during a year when much of the global market was still dealing with severe volatility shows a deep underlying resilience across multiple sectors in the kingdom.
So if we think about portfolio construction, risk is essentially like the spice in a culinary recipe.
No, another analogy. Okay.
Stick with me here. If you don't use any at all, your portfolio is incredibly bland. It's like a basic savings account that is actively losing purchasing power to inflation.
Right, completely bland.
But if you use way too much, the dish is completely unpalatable. It's a wildly volatile crypto or startup portfolio that could just go to zero overnight and keep you awake sweating.
A ruined dinner, basically.
Exactly. But if you take a carefully measured portion of your capital and allocate it to higher risk, higher yield opportunities,
yeah,
maybe early stage logistics tech or real estate investment trusts in these emerging locations, that's like adding a pinch of cayenne pepper.
It lifts the whole thing.
Yes. It dramatically lifts the overall profile and return of the entire dish without ruining your dinner.
What's fascinating here is how the specific macroeconomic landscape of Saudi Arabia actually alters the fundamental chemistry of that traditional risk recipe.
Wait, how so? Because at the end of the day, risk is risk, isn't it? An early stage development project has the exact same execution risks, whether it's in Riyadh or San Francisco.
In a pure free market vacuum, yes. But the text draws a massive distinction here.
Yeah.
In Saudi Arabia, these mega projects in tourism, real estate, and logistics are not operating in a vacuum. They have the absolute unwavering backing of long-term government policy.
Oh, I see.
This fundamentally changes the structural downside.
Ah, okay. I see exactly where you're going with this.
If you invest in a massive private development in the West and interest rates spike or demand softens, the developer might just go bankrupt and the project stalls completely. The downside risk is entirely borne by the investors.
Right. You lose everything.
But with initiatives under Vision 2030, these aren't just speculative real estate plays. They are national imperative.
They have to happen.
Exactly. The state has a vested strategic interest in their completion and success. This policy support essentially acts as a localized safety net. It effectively caps the catastrophic downside risk for investors in those specific sectors.
That is a massive distinction. So you are getting the high yield growth trajectory of an emerging market, but with the structural floor of a government-backed initiative.
Exactly.
That is a highly unusual combination. And it explains exactly why that institutional FDI we talked about earlier is still pouring in at 5.6%. They see the risk-adjusted returns are skewed heavily in their favor.
They absolutely do. And this realization perfectly tees up the source's strategic advice on diversification for anyone deploying capital in the region.
Because you can't just stick to the old playbook.
Right. The historical default for Gulf investments has obviously always been oil and gas.
The traditional undeniable backbone of the entire economy.
Yes, but the text is explicit. You cannot just sit in traditional energy holdings anymore. True risk mitigation now requires actively balancing those legacy energy positions with aggressive allocations into these emerging policy-backed sectors.
So diversifying into what exactly?
Moving capital into renewable energy grids, localized entertainment infrastructure, or commercial real estate within the NEOM ecosystem. That is how you diversify.
You keep the old and bring in the new.
You maintain the steady cash flow of the traditional sectors while capturing the exponential upside of the transformation, all while keeping your overall portfolio insulated from a localized downturn in any single industry.
Okay, so let's ground this. We understand the theory. We've looked at the necessity of foundational consistency. We've analyzed the macro tailwinds of the 2026 stabilization colliding with Vision 2030.
Right.
And we understand how government backing fundamentally alters the risk profile to our advantage. We even know we need to diversify away from purely oil and gas.
It's a solid framework.
It is a brilliant theoretical framework. But if you are the busy listener right now, how do you actually execute this?
The execution.
Yeah, if the real alpha is in early stage real estate in NEOM or a logistics hub in Diriyah Gate, how does an individual investor even get a foot in the door without millions in capital and like a team of full-time analysts?
This is where the source material transitions from theory to execution, and its answer is unequivocal. You have to let tech do the heavy lifting.
Tech, just basic apps.
Specialized technology. If you are trying to manually source deals, verify the regulatory backing, and model the projected yields on your own, you are fighting a losing battle against institutional algorithms.
Yeah.
The text insists that data equals less noise.
Right, relying on objective metrics rather than a gut feeling or some hot tip from a friend.
Exactly. Tech strips the emotion out of the execution. Use apps for auto investing, savings roundups, and price alerts to handle the boring stuff. But more importantly, it solves the exact problem you just highlighted, the access gap.
Okay, I want to dig into that concept of the access gap.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we were just talking about using basic stock screeners or portfolio trackers, are we actually gaining a serious competitive edge to find high returns?
Or are we just avoiding mistakes?
Yeah. Are we really just using software to prevent ourselves from making glaringly bad emotional mistakes?
Well, it accomplishes both. Reviewing data from past bad calls prepares you for the future. But the true edge comes from how modern platforms are democratizing the actual asset class.
Democratizing access.
Okay. The source points directly to platforms like Osul Gamma to illustrate this. These platforms are not just passive data trackers. They are actively structuring the market. They leverage technology to aggregate real estate deals, vet early stage development projects, and slice them into fractional investments.
Oh, wow. So they are essentially acting as the intermediary, doing the heavy lifting of due diligence and breaking down those massive capital barriers.
Precisely. They filter the noise of the broader market to find those solid, growing opportunities backed by the national policy we discussed.
Right.
They allow an everyday investor to deploy capital into a high-potential logistics hub or a commercial real estate project in a developing zone. Deals that historically required eight-figure minimums and a closed-door invitation to even look at the prospectus.
And the Osul Gamma insights touch on another highly tactical point regarding this execution, which is timing.
Timing is critical.
Because we established earlier that you shouldn't try to be a short-term market timer, trying to catch the daily swings of a stock. But the text clarifies that knowing when to enter a specific geographical real estate market still matters immensely.
It matters entirely. Long-term holding does not mean you should happily buy an asset at the absolute peak of its valuation just because you plan to hold it for 10 years.
Right, that would be terrible.
The source explicitly highlights the strategy of geographic timing, identifying areas that are just beginning their developmental curve.
The text specifically mentions regions like Abha and Alula, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
There is a massive yield differential between buying a premium commercial property in an already fully established, hyper-expensive district in Riyadh.
Versus somewhere new.
Versus utilizing a platform to get early, fractional access to hospitality infrastructure in Alula, as it is actively transforming into a global tourism hub.
Well, that makes total sense.
Getting in early on the development curve in those secondary markets provides a vastly superior compounding effect over the long term. Tech platforms provide the data to spot those emerging curves long before they peak.
So what does this all mean? If we pull all of these threads together for you as you review your own financial strategy this week, extracting real, tangible growth from your capital is not about being flashy.
Not at all.
It is certainly not about chasing the crash diet highs of a meme stock or trying to outsmart the daily news cycle. It starts with a brutal honesty about your own specific goals, using that to define your risk, and then locking into the boring, reliable consistency of dollar cost averaging.
Absolutely.
But the real leverage comes from understanding the specific macro environment. You have to recognize that in places like Saudi Arabia right now, the traditional risk-reward models are being skewed. Government-backed mega projects are creating high-yield opportunities with structurally lower downside risk.
And you must diversify.
Yes. You cannot afford to execute this manually. You have to diversify beyond the traditional oil and gas sectors by utilizing tech platforms like Osul Gamma to gain fractional access to the actual growth engines of tomorrow, like Alula and Neom, long before the broader market prices them out.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, what we are really witnessing is the democratization of alpha.
I love that phrase.
The momentum building in the Gulf in logistics, green energy, and tourism is real. It's heavily capitalized and structurally supported. Historically, everyday investors were locked out of these massive macroeconomic shifts simply due to a lack of access and capital.
The walls were too high.
But by applying the right theoretical framework and leveraging these new technological platforms, those walls have effectively been dismantled. The tools to build incredibly sophisticated high-growth portfolios are now widely available. The only variable left is whether you choose to apply them strategically.
And as we wrap up this deep dive, there is one final somewhat provocative thought buried in the source material that I want to leave you with.
Oh, this is a good one.
Yeah. The text talks extensively about the value of reviewing your past data, looking back at your portfolio to understand the times your timing was off, or when you let sheer panic or greed drive a bad trade. Learning from that emotional friction is a core part of becoming a better investor.
It's essential.
But as platforms like Osol Gamma continue to evolve, as auto-investing features become more predictive, and algorithms get better at vetting properties, slicing deals, and completely filtering out the noise of the market, how long until these algorithms fundamentally change human risk tolerance entirely?
It's a profound question.
Think about it. If the machine is doing the sourcing, the vetting, and the automated dollar-cost averaging, does the emotional roller coaster of investing eventually just disappear completely? If the data makes all the calls and manages the allocations, do we even need to build up an immunity to our own financial panic anymore? Or does the tech just insulate us from ourselves completely?
Wow.
Just something for you to ponder as you look at your dashboard this week. Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive. Keep learning, keep questioning, and stay curious.